polishing up an old talent, being a good and present parent, mastering a sport or an activity that once scared me, launching a social or an environmental project, or taking the positive results of one I started earlier to the next step. The second list is devoted to areas that still need improvement. That night, I like sitting in stillness for an hour. I meditate on those two lists. Where in my life have I done well? In what areas do I think I came up short, and why? Are the places where I gave my fullest attention, my marriage, my children, my work, my nutritional and exercise regimen, my spiritual practice, in balance? Or am I overdoing one while letting another slide? I also use my New Year's Eve meditation to set intentions and goals for the next year. Do I want to give up sugar again for a month? Is there something I haven't done that I've always wanted to do? What scares me, which to my mind means I need to try it? How can I become a better person, a better friend, a better mother, better at everything I do? If it sounds like I'm tracking myself or keeping score, well, I guess I am. My New Year's Eve list making is a form of self-analysis and a good way for me to measure my own development. I can feel good about whatever small victories I've achieved while reminding myself of the areas where I can still do better. It isn't a time for self-criticism. If I make that mistake, I reframe it as an opportunity for learning something new. It's also not a time to shower myself with praise. The big questions I always ask myself are, how well or how poorly did I use the time I was given this past year? Have I taken full advantage of the hours, days, weeks, and months that I was given? Have I prioritized what is most important to me? And have I given my best and most present attention? The lesson. Where your attention goes is what grows has always shown itself to be true for me. This is a very important lesson, especially in a time when we're saturated with more information than ever before. It can take a superhuman effort to slice through the physical clutter and mental fog around us in order to focus our attention on the things and goals that benefit us most and help us to grow. But the effort is worth it. What we need to understand is that where we place our attention is within our control. From experience, I know how easy it can be to allow other people to define us or limit our potential. If I had totally believed the bullies in my school or the people in the fashion industry who criticized my appearance, my self-doubt would have paralyzed me. Instead, I focused my attention even harder on what I wanted to accomplish. Should we really allow other people to tell us who we are, where we're going, and what we're capable of accomplishing? Those people had no idea that the qualities that they were making fun of were the very ones that made it possible for me to be in this field where I have been successful for 23 years. We all need to be careful with where our attention goes, and our attention always begins with our thoughts. Once we believe something is true, it becomes closer to coming true. If we have a poor opinion of ourselves, every encounter we have will be shaded by that belief. If we come into situations with confidence, our positive self-esteem will impact everyone around us. As a girl, I realized I had no control over my growing body. What was I going to do exactly? Saw my legs in half to make myself shorter? But I could turn something I didn't like into something I did like. Becoming a great volleyball player made being tall an asset. Plus, I could become a good student and focus on where I could have a positive influence. But this mindset meant that I had to overcome my own fears and insecurities. And this was especially true in my early days of modeling. The industry could be cruel in its treatment of girls. To some designers, models were hardly even human. We were hangers. I remember getting a job at age 15 as a fitting model, where I had to try out the potential looks for a show. I had to stand naked, except for my underwear, covering myself the best I could with my arms folded over my breasts while someone went to get me the outfits. Sometimes they would take forever, leaving me there shivering. No one thought to bring me a robe or thought about whether I might feel self-conscious or vulnerable or cold. Since I was new to modeling and didn't know any better, I told myself that this was just how things were. My first big break came in London. It was 1998. I was 18 years old. Since the mid-1990s, the trend in fashion had been known as heroin chic. Lots of skinny, waifish, mostly androgynous-looking girls. I had nothing in common with that look. I was healthy and tanned and athletic, and I had big boobs. I was living in a model's apartment in central London, where most of the other girls either smoked, drank, took drugs, or had piercings and tattoos. After 3 weeks and 43 castings, most of the people booking the shows barely looked at me. They weren't interested in any of the modeling work I'd done in Brazil. Not even a photo shoot where the hair and makeup artists had done their best to make me look boyish and cool. The heroin chic fad was probably a response to all the healthy, athletic models who dominated modeling in the early 90s. I didn't know that the pendulum was about to swing the other way, and that I was in a good situation to take advantage of it. One day, the agency sent me to a casting for the British designer Alexander McQueen's upcoming summer show. Lee, as his friends called him, had been chief designer at Givenchy before starting his own label, and even then he was considered one of the most creative, innovative designers of his time, known for a dramatic and unusual approach to fashion. When I got there, I joined hundreds, maybe even thousands of other girls in a line stretching out the door and around the block. One by one, we made our way into a long hallway that led to a room where Lee sat on a couch. He had me put on a pair of super high heels and a tight fishtail skirt, and then had me walk for him. When I was done, he said, "Thank you," and nothing else. I wasn't sure how it had gone. And a few days later, when my agency called with the news I'd made the cut, I couldn't believe it. The night of the show, I remember being struck by the fact that no one had called me in for a fitting. Maybe they'd figured out my dimensions from the fishtail skirt I had worn at the casting? I had done a few smaller shows in New York, but this was my first big international show, and I had no idea how it worked. That night, I arrived at the venue feeling like I had crazy butterflies in my stomach. I sat in a chair as the hairstylist pulled back all my hair and fitted me with a black wig, and the makeup artist glued long black feathers on my eyelashes. I was pretty sure that at some point someone was going to come and ask me to try on the clothes. At that time, I was barely 18. My English was still limited. I could say good morning and good afternoon and hi, how are you, and I'm fine, and make out a few things people were saying to me, but most of the time I just nodded and smiled a lot, since the last thing I wanted was to look dumb. Before showtime, it was chaos backstage, with a lot of stress and yelling. Soon it was time for all the girls, including me, to change into our outfits. We were given less than a minute to dress. I had three looks that night, three outfits. A stringy silver thing like a bathing suit, but with chains hanging off it, a dress, and the fishtail skirt. None of them had been fitted on me. I went out wearing the first two without any problems, though it was definitely fewer clothes than I'd ever worn on any runway. Now it was time for the fishtail skirt. Backstage, during a runway show, it's always rush, rush, rush. The rush to change clothes, the rush to touch up hair and makeup, the rush to line up and get back out on the runway. Someone pushed the fishtail skirt at me, and I changed into it. My legs could barely maneuver in the skirt, and the height of the heels made it nearly impossible to walk. I was still waiting for my top, and in my broken English, I finally asked someone where it was. "There is no top," came the answer. I began to cry. I had no idea what to do. Mostly, I thought about how disappointed and embarrassed my parents would be. I tried to hold back my tears, but they just kept coming down, and the black feathers glued to my lashes began coming unstuck. I could hear the heavy, crunching industrial beat coming from the runway. I thought about leaving, about running away. There was no way in the world I was going out there without a top. But if I left, I knew I'd probably never be given another opportunity. I'd be called unprofessional. That is, if casting agents bothered to call me anything at all. But in the end, it was my body, nobody else's. As soon as Val, the makeup artist, saw the situation, she said she would paint a top on me using white makeup, which she proceeded to do. It did look like a top, too. Val told me how beautiful it looked and said that the runway was so dark, no one would know I wasn't wearing a sheer white shirt. If Val hadn't shown up just then, I seriously doubt I could have walked the runway. I remember thinking that if anyone took photos of me, at least my parents wouldn't be able to recognize me in my black wig. At one point, I noticed that one girl, then another. No, wait. All the girls were coming backstage with their hair soaking wet. It took me a few seconds to grasp what was going on. I could already barely move in my tight fishtail skirt and high heels. Now I was about to go out there in a painted-on top, and it was also raining? That was probably the night I started to dissociate, to begin thinking of my public self as her and she. Because the girl who finally appeared on the runway wasn't anyone familiar to me. A few minutes earlier, I'd been crying so hard, my tears were washing off my makeup. I was a good girl. I was a tomboy. I was someone whose big breasts had embarrassed her since she'd hit puberty. I was a girl gripped by the fear that my family would feel so embarrassed they would never talk to me again. I was terrified. Thank God that the internet wasn't that popular in Horizontina back then. My parents would have ordered me to come back home. I trained my eyes to focus on a single light at the end of the runway and went out. No one saw the shy, scared, embarrassed, insecure 18-year-old girl that night. Instead, they saw a strong, confident woman in a skirt tight around her knees. She was managing to walk in impossible heels on an incredibly slippery stage. She didn't make any mistakes. She didn't fall. She gave off the impression she didn't have a care in the world. The rain made her black eye makeup run down her face, so no one could tell what was rain and what was tears. Fake it till you make it. I swear, it really does work. Thank God the whole thing began and ended quickly. It turned out that walking in Alexander McQueen's show was the beginning of my international career. He was seen as a genius, the best, most innovative designer of his time. The industry considered him a visionary. He was revered by every fashion editor and photographer in the industry, and many of them were in the audience that night. When he picked me to be in his show, my agency told me what a big deal it was, though I hadn't really taken it in. During the actual show, I was on the runway, half naked and crying, as rain came down from the ceiling. Looking back, I must have really stood out, especially in contrast to the heroin chic look everyone was used to. My boobs were big, and even though I was crying, I was healthy and fit. The industry was ready for a change. It was the right time, and that night, I was the right model. I was different, and the industry was ready for that difference. In one night, I'd somehow managed to claim a spot on the fashion world map. All of a sudden, lots of people wanted to work with me. People started calling me the girl of the moment. It was somewhat overwhelming, though some people still felt free to criticize me to my face. After modeling in a few shows in Milan and Paris, I flew back to New York, where a handful of people appeared in my life who would be instrumental in my career. The first three were top fashion photographers, and one is still a legendary magazine editor. First, Mario Testino booked me to be on French Vogue. Almost that same week, Patrick de Machalier booked me to be in Harper's Bazaar. Then I began working with Steven Meisel, who is not only an extremely talented photographer, but an incredible teacher, who really taught me how to model. A year later, Vogue editor-in-chief Anna Wintour put me on the cover of her magazine with the feature story, The Return of the Curve. Vogue is considered the fashion industry's Bible. When Anna made a pronouncement about a new fashion movement, in this case that curves were back, and chose me to illustrate that movement, it was an explosive moment in my career. I was one of the youngest models ever to appear on the cover of American Vogue. Inside was an Irving Penn photo of me nude. At the time, there were three legendary fashion photographers: Richard Avedon, Helmut Newton, and Irving Penn, who rarely took pictures anymore and who everyone wanted to work with. When my agent told me that Irving Penn wanted to photograph me nude, I was extremely hesitant. I didn't want to take off my clothes. I also didn't know how to say no to the biggest, most influential fashion magazine in the world and an icon who was one of the three most important fashion photographers in the industry. The whole idea made me uncomfortable, but my agency said it was very important, and I said I would do it. Frankly, I didn't feel I had much of a choice. Irving Penn, who was close to 80 years old when we met, was a genuine artist and a kind, respectful man. Normally, during photo shoots, there are more than a dozen people milling around, but he worked with only an assistant and Phyllis, the editor, and he shot using only natural light. At least he did the two times I worked with him. He was very courtly and old-fashioned. There was no retouching. Taking off my clothes wasn't easy for me. People might think that Brazilians fling their clothes off left and right, but I also grew up in a very Catholic family, and I felt uncomfortable standing there with nothing on. But I did what my agent said. I remember standing there naked, not moving, barely breathing, for almost 2 hours, with my face angled to the right. This also made me feel uncomfortable, since I'd convinced myself I only looked good from the left. "I don't think this side is so good, Mr. Penn," I said. I won't ever forget his response. In his slow, calm voice, he told me that everyone and everything has its own unique beauty, that every side is beautiful. When I finally saw the photo he took, I saw that he was right. The photo was different, but also, at least in my mind, beautiful. Though I literally couldn't move my neck for weeks afterwards. Years later, I chose this picture to be the cover of a book I edited, celebrating my 20 years in the industry. Working with Irving Penn freed me up in so many ways, not least of which was the realization that I looked different from other models, and that was okay. Another way many people thought I was confident, but which was actually something else entirely, was my way of walking the runway. As time went on, I became known for what some people called my horse walk. I would raise my knee high and kick my foot forward, which created the overall impression of a stomping mare. The truth is, I had no other choice. My feet are size 8, and I am 5 feet 11. The high heels that models wear are towering, making it almost impossible, in my case, to keep my legs straight. Imagine being my height and balancing on small feet inside very high heels, and you'll understand that my horse walk was just a way for me to keep from toppling over. It had another effect, too. It made the girl modeling on the runway, she, her, feel proud, strong, confident, and determined. I looked as if I were kicking things out of the way. Never mind that the heels I usually wore were so painful to walk in that I took them off the moment I was backstage. If before the Alexander McQueen show my attention was focused, afterward it became a laser. I'd known what I wanted, but now the possibilities seemed much bigger. I was committed to climbing the mountain I saw in front of me. As far as I was concerned, nothing was going to stop me. So what if one day I felt sick? Another day I had cramps, and a week later I was going through a bad patch in my personal life. Even when I felt like crying, I showed up with a smile, ready to work. Modeling uses up a lot of people. I'd already seen so many girls come and go, and I wasn't going to be one of them. As time passed, it seemed healthier and more protective of who I really was to think of modeling not as my identity, but as a business, which in fact it is. To me, that meant I had to master every element of that industry: hair, makeup, cameras, lighting, angles. The entire creative and collaborative process. The best way we learn how to do anything is by doing it. Day after day, my job gave me the opportunity to be surrounded by teams of amazingly creative people. I had great teachers. I set out to absorb and analyze anything and everything I could. I would sit there paying close attention when someone was doing my hair or makeup. I watched the photographers closely and learned about lighting and angles, and found out quickly that when you change the lens and the angle, you change everything. The most important factor for a photo to come out the way you want it to is lighting. In contrast, the angle is what makes a photo interesting or not. Is it a conventional front-facing photo? Is the photo shot from a lower angle, which has the effect of making me look taller, or shot from the top, which makes me look smaller? Or is the photo shot from one side in a more deliberately artistic way? If lighting creates a mood, the angle can determine whether the photo is different or unusual, or just plain commercial, although lighting can do that too. So I began analyzing photos that were poorly lit. That doesn't look good. Why? The more I understood about lighting and angles, the better my photos got. I could see how one beam of light complemented my face, while another made it look weird, and how moving my chin a millimeter to the left or right subtly altered the entire effect. I was always trying to find angles where my nose looked less pronounced and my eyes looked bigger. In the end, I gained a much greater understanding, not just of my role in the collaboration, but also the parts everyone else played. Some people might have seen me as a hanger, but I was analyzing and trying to learn. Having worked with the top people in fashion for so many years also gave me the opportunity to help hairstylists and makeup artists with less experience. I knew what made me look good. "Maybe you could try putting the eyeshadow this way," I'd say, "or my hair this way." I wanted to help all of us. Luigi, a dear friend and probably the best hairstylist I've ever worked with, as well as being a great photographer, jokes that he loves being my hair assistant because I'm good at playing with my hair during shoots, as it helps me get into character. By its nature, modeling is a time-limited, youth-oriented industry. Models face a lot of temptations and situations where they can easily slide off the rails. Most girls begin modeling around the same age I did, in their early teens, a time when they are heavily influenced by their peers. At that age, you just want to fit in. And in a business where there's a lot of partying, drinking, drug-taking, and glamour, where the emphasis is pretty much exclusively on how you look, that can be a dangerous combination. "How long are you going to be doing this, Jeezy?" I asked myself. Back then, there was no good answer, but I knew one thing for sure. When the time arrived that I was no longer offered jobs, I wasn't planning on going home empty-handed. If nothing else, I wanted to own my own place. What was the point of paying rent when I could use that same money to get a mortgage and buy my own apartment? I began squirreling away whatever funds were left over at the end of each month. I'd never been interested in expensive clothes or handbags or shoes. I was more of a hippie. If I needed new clothes, I paid a visit to one of the downtown flea markets. Why buy new clothes when I was going to be dressing up at the studio? When I got more successful and clients began sending me first-class airline tickets, I traded them for seats in economy, and the money I saved went straight into my savings account. That's how I was able to buy my first ever apartment in New York, on Beach Street in Tribeca. It was a small apartment without much light, but I loved it because it was mine. After moving in, I didn't have much money left to pay for renovations, so I did most of them, following my mom's example of always trying to do everything herself. I sanded and stained the floors, and I did the same with four white benches I found at a street sale on Houston Street. Those four benches come with me wherever I go, and they sit today in our kitchen in Boston. I furnished the other rooms at IKEA. To remind myself of Brazil, I bought standing trees and a fish. I did need to hire someone to renovate my bathroom, so for the next 6 months I took showers at the studio or at a friend's house. A lot of girls couldn't believe it when I told them I bought my own apartment. But I always kept my eyes straight ahead. I always knew what I was working for. What we choose to focus our attention on is so very important. First comes the thought. Why? Because before you can aspire to something or act on something, you need to imagine what that thing is. The more you think about something, the stronger your thoughts around it become, and eventually it turns into a belief. When I was having my panic attacks and drinking mocha frappuccinos, smoking a pack of cigarettes a day, and drinking a bottle of wine at night, it became a kind of belief system. That belief system told me I was a person constantly on the go, who needed to smoke all day to keep moving, and drink wine every night to relax. That was what I believed I needed to do to keep going. Smoking and drinking wine were the actions I took based on that belief system. The cures, meditating, running every morning, and making changes in my diet, were actions based on my new belief system. I thought meditating and doing yoga could help me, and slowly, as they did, those thoughts evolved into a positive, life-altering belief. Your thoughts can destroy you, or your thoughts can catapult you to new and better places. But whatever you choose to do as a result of your thoughts, make sure you do it for the right reasons. When you do something to satisfy yourself, something you really feel will make you happier, it's a wonderful thing. But the moment you do something to just please other people or society or the culture, it can backfire on you, as I know very well. As I said earlier, after the Alexander McQueen show, the fashion industry began referring to me as the body. I'd become extremely at ease in that body. But after my children were born, Benny in 2009 and Vivi in 2012, quite naturally my body began to change, especially after breastfeeding each child for almost 2 years. Although breastfeeding was one of the most special experiences of my life, and I am so grateful I was able to do it, on the other hand, it not only made my breasts much smaller, it made them slightly lopsided. The fact is, no matter how healthy you are, or how regularly you work out, if you're a woman, your body is going to change after pregnancy and birth. Besides that, I wasn't 19 anymore. I was in my early 30s and a young mother. For years, I was labeled the body, and the fashion industry had high expectations for the way I looked. But time passes for all of us, and we all change. When I showed up for jobs, some people would make comments, indirectly or more pointedly. "What happened to your boobs?" they would say. Or, "Your boobs have gotten so small." Some even suggested I add padding, what the industry calls chicken cutlets, to my bra. Well, if where our attention goes is what grows, I now became preoccupied by the size and condition of my breasts. Suddenly, I was very self-conscious about the way they looked. At the same time, I had always wanted to give my best, and I felt somehow I was no longer able to live up to the expectations that others had of me. Still, it wasn't within my power to revert to the body I had before I had children. Which led me to make one of the most upsetting decisions of my life. I never considered getting plastic surgery, even when people made comments about my nose or my eyes or made me feel inadequate. But this time around, unfortunately, I chose to give attention to the comments I was hearing. I decided to get breast surgery. My thinking was this: if I get my breasts enhanced, no one will make those comments anymore and I will feel like myself again. I chose to trust my surgeon, believing he knew what was best for me. But trust me, I have learned that no one knows better than you what is best for you. When the surgery was over, I no longer recognized my body. I became uncomfortable with the size of my breasts. I felt angry and depressed. Why did I do this to myself? Why did I let my attention go there? I'd done something for myself, but mostly to try to please others. The lesson here is to listen to yourself first, to be clear about what you want before making important decisions. After all, you will be the one living with the results. If, on the other hand, our attention focuses on positive things, it will grow in positive ways. For example, I've always loved nature, but it wasn't until I visited the indigenous tribes in the Amazon in Brazil in 2004 that I came face to face with the crises created by deforestation. My visit was profound and eye-opening, and when I left, I told myself I had to do something to help preserve the natural resources. I asked Grendene, the Brazilian company I worked with for years on a line of sandals, to please help me bring attention to environmental causes. We decided that a percentage of our annual profits would be donated to help protect the Xingu River, which flows into the Amazon, and to help support various other environmental causes, including the regeneration of forest, water, and endangered species in Brazil. I wanted to do all I could to bring attention to environmental problems, so we also partnered with a group in America to create a web cartoon series for kids called Giselle and the Green Team, about a group of teenage girls who live double lives as supermodels and environmental superheroes. In Horizontina, my dad and I created Agua Limpa, whose mission is to regenerate the water quality. This effort led to some awards and recognition. The United Nations asked me to be one of their goodwill ambassadors. Harvard University also took notice of the work I was doing. Years later, this work led me to give a speech at Rock in Rio. In the past few years, much of my attention has been focused on working on behalf of the environment, as my concern for the Earth and future generations is enormous, and I hope to inspire everyone to help. I bring careful attention to the information I take in every day, and how I feed and nourish my own mind. As a public figure, I know there's a lot written about me online, almost all of it by people who don't know me. Some of it is negative and unkind. Online, people make comments about other people they don't know, comments that they would never express if they were face to face. Computers are machines, and emails, texts, and online remarks detach us from the idea that another human being is on the other end. Anonymity doesn't just create detachment. It also seems to facilitate cruelty. It's hard for me to believe that anyone with a happy life would go online for the sole purpose of saying nasty things about someone they don't know. This is worse than the kids who bullied me in middle school, because the number of people who make comments online is much larger. Happy people have better things to do. My whole life I've thought of myself as a happy person. I'm fortunate. I have my husband and children to love, and work I still need to accomplish. If I gave all my attention to the internet or the latest breaking news, the quality of my life would change, and not for the better. My phone would become my focus, and my fear, anxiety, and helplessness would grow. In my 20s, I remember having awesome days at work or with friends, and then getting home and turning on the TV, or going online and seeing something that upset me so much, I became really down for the next few days. Focusing too much of your attention on the news or on the internet or on anything outside yourself can consume you. It isn't your life, but it might as well be your life. If you keep giving your full attention to things that make you fearful or anxious, you will become more fearful and anxious. On the rare occasion that I check the online news, I often find myself reading words or watching images that remind me of the stray floating thoughts I'm aware of during meditation. They come and go from 1 hour to the next, 1 day to the next. It can be helpful to ask, does letting your attention focus on this or that information benefit you or connect you to your best, highest self? When I was asked to take part in the opening ceremonies of the 2014 FIFA World Cup, I was torn. Like a lot of Brazilians, I believed Brazil could have used the money being spent on stadiums and running tracks for other, more urgently needed things, like improving hospitals, schools, and the infrastructure. But in the end, I said yes. I felt it would be an honor to represent my country as an opportunity to make a positive contribution. I thought, not for the first time, that darkness is nothing more than the absence of light. All my attention was now focused on trying to give off as much light, hope, and positive energy as possible, and to represent my country in the best way that I could. I had the same feeling when I was asked to walk the runway at the opening of the 2016 Rio Olympics. My goal, and I hope this doesn't sound too grandiose, was that I could serve somehow as an inspiration, a positive image for Brazil. It would be a privilege, in fact, and I would experience something I would never have the opportunity to experience again. I had to do it. When I got to Rio and took the car to my hotel, I couldn't help overhearing what they were saying on the radio. All of it was negative. No one believed Brazil could host a successful Olympic ceremony. As a result, I was apprehensive about the whole situation. But I also knew that whenever I'm afraid of stretching myself, that's when I need to be brave. If I'm unwilling to dare or try something new, I close off opportunities to experience the benefits that could come about as a result. The biggest successes in my life have all come about when I reached beyond my own comfort zone. My task at the Olympics was to walk more than 400 feet by myself. Just me. No one else. Thousands of people would be crowded inside a dark stadium, and millions more around the world would be watching on television. Many things can happen or go wrong in 400 feet. What if I fell? Thank God I have never fallen during a show, but I knew it could happen. I'd lost a shoe, broken a heel, and gotten the tail of my dress caught in my heel plenty of times, but I'd never fallen. Before going on, I said a short prayer. I asked for protection, strength, and courage. I asked to be a conduit, a messenger of light and love. Then the glare of the spotlight hit my head. When I felt that light, I was aware of the enormous positive energy in the darkness around me. Behind a center stage piano, Daniel Jobim, the grandson of Antonio Carlos Jobim, Tom Jobim, the great Brazilian composer who introduced bossa nova to the world, played and sang his grandfather's song, The Girl from Ipanema, as I began my walk. It may have just been me up there on the stage, but every one of my guardian angels was walking with me. The world might have been watching one woman walking a darkened runway, but I didn't do it alone, not for a second. I like to embrace every opportunity that life gives me. I like to challenge myself, to experience new things, because we never know how much time we have left. Time is our biggest gift, and I don't want to waste any of it. We have only a limited number of hours, days, and years to experience the magic of this life, the beauty of our planet, and the sensation of being inside our bodies. My relationship with time, and my feeling that there's never enough, lies behind my impatience and also my self-discipline. There is still so much I want to do. Because time is precious, I often reflect about how to use it wisely. How am I using my time? Am I spending it with the people I love? Am I being mindful and present in each moment? Am I learning about people, ideas, or situations that will feed me in a positive way? Am I reading books or magazines that teach and inspire me and bring me joy? Am I focusing my attention on things that might be out of my comfort zone but help me grow? The important point is that we can choose to put our attention on the areas of our life that will support us being our best. Chapter 6. Nature, Our Greatest Teacher. In Horizontina, where I grew up, there were no traffic lights, no movie theaters. The roads were mostly cobblestone, with the exception of the main one, where there was the hospital, also the bank where my mom worked, and SLC, the heavy agricultural equipment factory that employed most of the residents and was later taken over by the machinery company John Deere. The closest town wasn't much bigger, with only about 30,000 people, and Porto Alegre, the state's capital city, was 7 hours east by car. Many of us look back on childhoods that seem simple and innocent and joyful, maybe because we were. But my childhood actually was. In my town, everyone knew everyone. Cars would slow down when the driver saw us jumping rope in the streets, and people would chat with one another. There was no such thing as a locked door. At age 4, I toddled over to the house belonging to our neighbors, Karina and Melissa, let myself in, and fell asleep watching cartoons on their couch with my bottle by my side. It was that kind of place. But more than its friendliness and safety, and the freedom my sisters and I felt walking home from school or riding our bikes wherever we wanted, I remember most being surrounded by nature. The fruit-bearing trees, so many different birds, the rows of blackberry bushes, the warm grass, the sand when my parents took us to the ocean on vacation, the mud under my bare feet, and above my head always the huge, warm, brilliant sky. When I say nature is our greatest teacher, you might wonder what exactly nature teaches us. Nature is a pretty big category after all, and we grow up learning about it in pretty disconnected ways. In science, we might memorize types of leaves or cloud shapes, or learn about our solar system or the moon's effect on the tides. Social studies teaches us geography and borders and population growth. Not many people link together what these subjects have in common. Nature. Maybe the better question is to ask, what doesn't nature teach us? To me, nature is everything. She is the highest, greatest expression of creation, love, and compassion. No matter how many times I watch the sunrise, or hear the rain falling, or see a wave rolling into shore, or a flock of geese flying, I am completely awestruck. In order to stay alive, to eat, drink, breathe, and absorb light from the sun, we need to maintain a continuous exchange with nature. If the flow of this exchange is interrupted, we pay the price. Nature gives us life. Without her, none of us would be here. When did we start forgetting that our lives depend on this exchange? Like most people, I grew up believing church was just a place you went on Sundays. But why confine God to a man-made structure? I believe nature herself is our church. She is certainly mine. If you attune yourself to the energies of love, compassion, and service that nature provides, you can see God, who is, I prefer to think, the Creator, in everyone and everything. It's as if by giving us life, the lakes and oceans, the trees, fields, and deserts, creation wanted to experience itself. Nature is intelligent. She is in balance. She is patient. She is wise. I believe that if we got into the habit of devoting even a few minutes every day to restore the connection between ourselves and nature, we would feel a profound and positive shift. I know that in my own life, this connection brings me incredible peace and joy. I believe that we can choose to live in heaven or hell right here on earth. Both are in our own minds. We are helping create either one. Rather than letting other people decide whether you're good or bad, the choice is up to you. If we can all agree God is love, then everything that is unloving is the opposite of God. We are living in an information age. I don't think it is a coincidence that it seems like today, more than ever, people are disconnected from nature and from themselves. We forget to go outside. Instead of going for a walk, sitting on a rock, listening to a stream or strolling on the beach, we are using an app or a video that duplicates those experiences and sounds. Most of us have trouble just being. Being with ourselves, being with other people. When was the last time you went out for lunch or dinner and no one took out their phone? There's a quote I love that says we have only two ways to live our lives. One is as if nothing is a miracle. The other is as if everything is a miracle. Nature shows me that everything is a miracle. My whole life I've been susceptible to what I call energy. The energy other people give off. the energy I pick up when I enter a room. Everyone and everything releases some kind of vibration. I know I'm not alone in this experience. A lot of people are sensitive, some more than others. No doubt science has an explanation for it, or maybe a way to dismiss the whole subject. But nothing felt more real to me than the energy I was aware of, starting when I was very young. As a little girl trying to get to sleep at night, I sometimes felt a presence in the bedroom I shared with my sisters, a sensation of heat or cold. I couldn't see what I was feeling. I didn't want to see it, but I could sense it. Those presences were like the sudden hot and cold pockets of water your skin touches against when you're swimming in the ocean or a lake. Anytime I felt one in my bedroom, I dove underneath my blanket or whispered fiercely to Pachi or Gabi to wake up, or else I'd jump onto the bunk underneath mine where Fafi slept. Whatever it was scared me. I didn't want to think about what it could be. But those presences were as real to me as going to school or playing volleyball or doing my chores. Humans are seekers of knowledge. We are searching for ways to understand ourselves and make sense of the world, ways that might be different from what we were taught. Maybe what we're looking for are experiences that give us meaning and a feeling of connection. Nature makes me feel that way. Nothing gave me more joy when I was young than helping my grandmother in her garden, or climbing a tree, or when I was immersed in the ocean water when our whole family went to the beach. Nature was as tangible a presence as any one of my sisters. Whatever energy I was giving off seemed to vibrate in harmony with her. Nature wasn't ever something other than me. She was me. She is all of us. This feeling from childhood has never gone away. Every moment I spend in nature reminds me of how my little place in the world connects to something vast and awesome. All I need to do is take a walk behind my house, or see a bird flying in the distance, or go surfing in the early morning, and nature brings me back to balance. She nurtures my soul. Most of us don't really see trees. We treat them as scenery, part of our landscape. We seldom stop to think about what trees actually represent. Aside from being beautiful, they take in carbon dioxide, storing carbon and releasing the oxygen that we breathe. They trap pollutants in their branches and leaves. In the form of forests, they help create rain that balances our climate. They help shield us from ultraviolet rays. They offer shade, which cools roads and houses and lawns. They give us the wood we use to build houses. They increase the amount of moisture in our air and slow down soil erosion. They give us food in the form of nuts and fruits, and they can contain powerful medicines and poisons within their leaves or bark. The first home for many of us is a crib made of wood, and the last one a coffin. And in between, many of us live in wooden framed houses. Just think about the miracle that is a tree. They are truly wonderful. Now think about your own body. So many aspects of our body need to be working simultaneously for any of us to be alive. Our hearts beat, our lungs take in and expel air, our veins circulate blood, oxygen, and nutrients. Our immune and lymphatic systems fight off infections. Our digestive system breaks down food. And our brains orchestrate the entire process by sending messages out to every part of our bodies. Do we ever stop to think about how miraculous that is, and how miraculous nature is? I tell my children that God, or our Creator, is the energy of love that comes from abundance. The evidence of that love and creation is everywhere and in everything. It's in the day and the night, the rocks and the grasses, the trees and the plains, the planets and the oceans. It's in you and me and all of us. God created nature, and nature is God. When I think back to the panic attacks I had in 2003, I wonder if they would have been as bad if I hadn't been spending all my time in a city. Manhattan buildings close off the sun and sky. Whole blocks are in shadow, and artificial lights and pollution blind people from seeing the stars at night. During my panic attacks, all I wanted was to be in nature. I found myself longing for the little cabin I used to have in Woodstock, New York. At that time, on free weekends, or sometimes just for the day, I would drive up there by myself, with Joni Mitchell playing on the CD player. Once I was there, I'd spent most of my time outside, walking, soaking in the sun, gazing at the nearby pond, listening to birds, and now and again catching a glimpse of a black bear, aware all the time that nature was healing me. I'll never forget how the earth seemed slowly to pull away all the tensions that had built up during the week. Nature, and my reverence for it, is still a large part of my day-to-day life, and that includes my mealtimes. Before I eat, I always bring my hands together over my plate, close my eyes, and say a short blessing. As I said, I believe everything is alive and gives out energy, including my food. If I'm eating a salad for lunch, I focus on the fact that everything in front of me, the lettuce, the carrots, the beets, were once seeds. As those seeds grew, they were warmed and nourished by the earth, the sunlight, and the rain. Now they're nourishing my body. The least I can do is have gratitude and honor that cycle. I say thank you to my food and ask that it nourish every part of my being. I end my blessing by saying thank you three times. Why three times? I don't know. It just became a habit. Only then do I start eating. Vivi doesn't think much of my ritual, but Benny says a blessing now too, and Vivi will sometimes. None of us is automatically entitled to food, and I don't ever want to take for granted what's on my plate. Too often we gulp down what's there without thinking, as we're reading or watching television or playing with our phones. Blessing my food before I eat means that I'm giving it my fullest respect and attention. When I'm in Costa Rica, my favorite time to go surfing is at 5 a.m., when no one is around except the pelicans and dolphins. I always ask permission to the ocean before going in. What am I to the ocean? A little speck. That's why, before I enter the water, I take a few moments to say a short prayer. I ask the ocean's permission to swim in it and for its protection. I feel I'm creating a contract between us, as well as showing a respect and reverence for the water. To be perfectly honest, every time I go surfing, I'm afraid. Afraid of sharks. Afraid of being pulled under by a strong current. Afraid of drowning. As a kid, I used to go in the ocean a lot and loved jumping into the waves. One day, I was swimming in the ocean with Gabi and Pachi and our cousin Lisi, who was the oldest. I didn't know it was dangerous to swim near the rocks, especially because the currents were strong, but I was young, and the tide was high. Gabi was swimming next to me, and then a moment later, I heard her scream. Without even thinking, I paddled toward Gabi, and then both of us were caught in a powerful current. Pachi screamed for help, and Lisi tried to grab us, but then she got trapped. About 20 people were standing on the beach. They somehow managed to form a human rope and pulled us onto shore. I'd never felt so helpless or afraid in my life, and for years after that, I stayed out of the water. But as I got older, I really missed being in the ocean and wanted to go back to having fun in it. At first, I went in only as far as my ankles before taking a seat in the sand. One day, I decided to buy a surfboard so I could at least float on something. I've now been surfing for many years. So far, the ocean has taken extremely good care of me, and I've certainly experienced joy from being in its presence. Visiting my grandmother's small farm as a girl played a big part in developing my love and reverence for nature. My grandmother planted and grew most of what she ate, and season by season I watched as the seeds she buried in the soil and nurtured became sprouts and later vegetables or individual herbs, which she traded with her neighbors. I grew to appreciate how one season produced one fruit or vegetable, and the next season another crop entirely. I could see the cycles of nature at work, the long journey a seed traveled to become the food on my plate. Spending time on her farm was when I first realized that everything on our earth is alive. Whether it's a blade of grass, a grain of rice, or a piece of fruit, and that I should appreciate everything and never take anything for granted. From my grandmother, I also absorbed the importance of eating locally grown foods. One of the biggest disconnections from nature that I see is the way most people shop for groceries. It's common to buy fruits, vegetables, meat, seafood, and poultry without knowing where they came from, or whether the producers have added chemicals and stabilizers to the food. Most of the produce my family eats comes from local farmers and growers. I'm a big believer in eating locally grown food, and to my way of thinking, no two jobs are as important and underappreciated as farming and teaching. If you think about it, farmers and teachers are similar. Farmers grow and nourish the food we eat, and teachers grow and nourish